Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, listeners. I'm your host, G.D. Welcome to iArtist on A Touch of Grace. Today's date is Monday, January 20th, 2014. The time is 1:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Born January 15, 1929, and assassinated April 4, 1968, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was a symbol of power and hope, as well as a humanitarian who led people of color from an oppressive existence toward freedom and equality for all people. I dedicate today's broadcast in his memory. Sherrod O'Neill Glossin is a Detroit, Michigan native, born and raised. Like many of us, he attended church services in his youth. He comes from a spiritual family that has had generations of preachers. His mother is an evangelist and stepfather is an elder. During his association with the church, he discovered his musical talents, playing drums. He graduated from Detroit City High School, where his athletic abilities were honed in the sport of basketball, which led him to being a player at Delta College, where he majored in English. His life took a detour when he entered into a relationship with street life and, unfortunately, found himself behind bars serving a 6-year sentence in the Michigan penal system. This was around his 21st birthday. In the thralls of an institutional existence, he eventually stumbled upon another love, a gift he had, and that gift was writing, which he cultivated sometimes in the wee hours of the morning, like between 3 and 4. The end result of those writings became the novel entitled When Water Becomes Thicker Than Blood, and it only took him 2 months to write. He attained knowledge of how to publish a book while in prison and published it under his own company name. On July 26, 2012, he was released from his correctional cocoon, and 2 days later, he prepared for his first book signing. This true life tale of redemption and success is true inspiration in a bottle, and I am so very honored to have him on the show. Sherrod, welcome to iArtist. How are you doing today?
GD, yes, man. I'm doing extremely well, man. I appreciate, you know, everything that you're doing right now for me and for everyone else, man. It's truly an honor and a pleasure, you know, to be spending, you know, these next 45 minutes to an hour with you this afternoon.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, I want to say thank you because I know that you had a very fun-filled weekend with the ski trip. And, you know, I'm just honored to have you on and to be able to provide a platform for you because it's so deserving. So I guess the place to start, to give the listeners a little feel of actually who you are, who is the man, Sherrod O'Neill Glossin?
Well, Sherrod, you know, Glossin, I'm definitely a person who's constantly seeking, you know, within self, trying to figure out what can I do as well as, you know, what can I help be done versus with the community. I think it's very important nowadays, especially for young men in that generation. You know, I'm only 28 years old, but if you look at the way that the generation is going right now, man, the older people look at it like it's corrupt. You know, so it was. I went through a situation where I was put in an environment to where I was able to, you know, come find within self, you know, get out here and try to help people out. You know, so it's all about me experiencing life and trying to get people to, you know, open up their minds and continue to be positive and move forward instead of being part of a statistic that society has already placed upon them, you know, especially with, you know, the black community. So what I am, man, I'm just a humble dude.
Well, you know what? What I want to say, as an older guy myself, I'm 51, what I want to say is that, yeah, when you're looking at the view of our youth today, you know, the youth today are definitely of higher intelligence. And being of higher intelligence, you would think that that it would be more better than bad. So I know that there are young people out there that are misunderstood. I had a educator and a dean from the New York City School District on a couple of days ago, and he works with a lot of the youth, and he's one of those special people that can get into the mind of the youth so that they can find their way, to help them find their way, because, you know, there's a lot of pride. So I already shared quite a bit about the man, Sherrod O'Neill Glosson, but there's nothing better than hearing it firsthand. So tell us about your earlier life and what it was like growing up in Detroit.
Growing up in Detroit, you know, it has a reputation for music, and it has that positive reputation of being a motor city, but actually being in a city, it comes off a difference when you're growing up. It's very fast-paced, and although Detroit is, like, known for birthing hustlers, you know, it also has a negative side to it, you know. So my family, you know, they did their best of keeping me around or from around a certain type of crowd. So they kept me at church growing up. I grew up in a church. My whole family is church-oriented. You know, my grandfather's a pastor. My grandmother's a missionary and first lady. Then you have my mom, who's the mother of the church, and my dad, who's an elder. So I grew up with this type of foundation, because they say you train up a child in the way that he should go, so when he gets old, he does not depart from it. So I definitely grew up in the church. Whether I like going every Sunday or not, you know, it was important that I go. You know, even if my mom didn't go, my grandma made sure that I was in the church. So by being in the church, you know, obviously I had to find something that made me want to come. You know, a lot of people, I remember Steve Harvey said, what made him come was, you know, when he was watching the other people react to other church members. So with me, I started playing the drums. I remember like it was yesterday. I was only probably like 7 years old. Church was over, and I used to just always watch the guy on the drums, like always, because, you know, my grandma used to make me sing in the choir and stuff like that. So after church one day, as everyone was walking out, I remember seeing my mom. I think she was, like, in the back of the crowd walking out the door, and I just went over to the drums, and I just started playing. Like, I just already knew what I was doing. You know, mind you, I'm only 7 years old at the time. And since then, man, you know, I took that gift, and I just kept going, you know, playing and different concerts and different things like that. So by the time I got, you know, to high school, now you're older. So now you have a little bit more decisions that you make for yourself. You know, my mom gave me a little bit more freedom, of course. So I started, you know, hanging out a little bit more, started experiencing different things other than, you know, what I was taught in church. I went to college, thought, and that was very important, though, that my mom, you know, my grandmother didn't want me to go to college. So by the time I got to college, I'm playing basketball. I'm doing things that I, you know, wanted to do. I grew up, you know, I love basketball. So I started playing sports, got into basketball, got into college or whatever. And then ultimately I ended up stopped going. Not because, you know, college wasn't, you know, for me, as someone would say, you know, the whole college is for me thing. But I stopped going to college and I dropped out. And it wasn't long after that. And I was like, nah, you know what, I need to get back into school. So I got back into school, and this time I went to school over in Canada. You know, my high school basketball coach hooked me up with a gig out there while I was playing basketball out there. And, you know, just adventuring out, you know, in Canada, you know, it's not like over here in Detroit where we have Windsor that's just right across the bridge. But, you know, here I was almost 24 hours away, so I was deep in Canada. And stayed over for a little while, came back home. You know, now, you know, I'm older now. I think I'm like 20 at the time. So I'm hanging out. You know, I'm almost at the age where, you know, I can legally drink, and, you know, I'm almost about to be 21. So finding myself around, you know, a lot of people that I wasn't supposed to be around, and even in that, it was a learning experience, because now what I think a lot of people, or now I'll use myself as an example, when I was younger, I had a hard time with, like, telling people no. You know, a lot of people are not firm in whatever they're saying. They can say, you know, no, I don't drink, or no, you can't drink around me, but they're saying that, but they're still not acting on it. Like, if I tell you, no, you can't drink around me, I'm going to be firm in that. Like, I'm not going to allow you to do that, right? Mm-hmm. So
right.
I dealt with that, you know, a lot growing up, and ultimately not being firm in my decision-making or who I allow to be around me. You know, I kind of got into it myself. You know, I kind of allowed that type of environment to be around me. It ultimately dragged me down. you know, into going into prison. I hear this quote. It says, you stay in a bar long enough, you're going to drink, right? And
right.
If you actually look at that, a lot of people are like, no, I ain't going to drink. But the thing is, if you're not going to drink, you wouldn't have found yourself in a bar in the first place, right? It was that whole thing growing up. And I did a little time in prison. Well, not a little time, but I did 6 years. It was horrible. I will be the first person to tell you it was horrible. But one thing about it is it allowed me to just exclude everything that was going on around me. You know, even though prison, you know, it's a negative place and it's miserable because you got guys in there that's in there for the rest of their lives. But it also allows you to sit back. You know, you're not out here in the streets where you can be doing one thing or trying to focus and then your phone rings and someone says, hey, let's go hang out. Or you don't have any distractions, especially with social media. So those was out of the park, and I had, you know, that time all I had was me. You know, me and them little four walls and prison walls, and I started writing, and ultimately I created the book out of it. And now it's, you know, it started making me think more positive, and now I'm just out here and I'm running with it.
All right, I think it is definitely courage. And that's what we sometimes forget because, like you, I had a problem with saying no. And what winds up happening, we wind up getting into situations with alcohol and substances that take us outside of ourselves. So we're not really making the best decisions for ourselves. We wind up in slippery slopes with different people that have their own issues. And so we subject ourselves to that, and no matter how much of a good background we come from, the church or whatever, when you're out there in the street and you're using and doing all of these things, then you wind up in places where, you know, you have to almost pay for the wrong decisions that you make. So the question that I have when we're talking about coming from a family of ministers and religious people, what I'd like to say is, or ask is, what were the challenges like coming from such, or being a child of such a religious family? Because usually they have a tight hold on you. So what was that like for you?
Well, it was almost like pressure, because you feel like you're doing something that you're really not comfortable doing, you know? So it's kind of like working a job or having to work a job, and every Monday it's like, you know, you got this job, so every Monday is like, man, it's Monday again. You know, so it's kind of like feeling pressure to doing something like that. And I think that's what, like, forces people out of the church. When it comes to, like, preachers' kids and stuff like that, if we feel like we bring pressure into going to church and it's something that we're really not interested in, then we're not going to feel comfortable in doing that. So a lot of people find themselves up out of that. I think that's what I dealt with a lot, you know, growing up. Like, I have to go to church. Like, it's Wednesday, it's the middle of the week, and, you know, I have to stop playing outside because I have to go to Bible study. Or it's Saturday, and it's really 90 degrees outside, and it's afternoon, I'm with my friends, but it's time for me to go to choir rehearsal. And it's Sunday, and a lot of my friends are at home and watching games and outside playing, but I have to go to church. And don't let it be a Sunday where it's two services going on in a day. Right?
Amen.
I done gave up a lot of my weekends just to go to church. So it's kind of like pressure a little bit.
Yeah, it definitely must have been. Like my grandmother, like your grandmother, made sure that we were in church. And though we didn't have any ministers in our family, you know, most certainly, you know, Sunday, you can count on being there in those seats. And the funny thing about all of that is that we're there. And then as soon as we turn the ripe old age of 20, 21, then we are given a new license in life to go out and to explore. And again, you know, sometimes we don't make the best decisions, you know, and I'm certainly one of those that definitely have had my own trials and tribulations in the street as well. So you mentioned that you, at 7 years old, you had heard people playing the drums in church, and you just started playing the drums. So, you know, when instances like this happen, I honestly believe that there is a higher power at work. So there are great entertainers who hone their skills while at church, and so many of us have found street life intoxicating. So for you, what was the biggest allure of street life for you?
The biggest allure, I would say it was more like an it's like you're at some point you're almost fascinated by the things that people are doing that they're not supposed to do, but they're getting away with it, you know? So it's like, I remember the first time I did shoplifting with some people, and, you know, I wasn't, you said that, like, I wasn't a stealer, but when I seen or heard people, like, you know, even females, you know, like, yeah, we went to this store and we took these pair of jeans and we got away with it. Wait, how? I thought it was against the law. Like, every time you do it, something's going to happen, right?
So right.
It was more like an adrenaline, like, how did you get away with that? Like, I didn't know that that can occur, you know? It pulls you in, so now it makes you think, like you telling me that you've been doing this for how long? You went in there and you put on a pair of pants or you put on a pair of shirt up under your original shirt in the changing room, right, and you just walked out, right? So it's kind of wondering, like, I wonder if I can do that too, right?
Uh-huh.
So it makes me wonder. So, and then when you actually do it, now it becomes more of a rush, right? So mm-hmm. I think that's what happens. And I think that's what it all boils down to. Is it more of an adrenaline rush? Like when people are doing drugs, like when people are, let's just use, are used to smoking marijuana, right? Or are used to smoking mm-hmm. cigarettes. You know, a lot of people say, like, I smoke cigarettes just for a little buzz. But then when someone comes and say, you know what, I found something that's a little bit stronger. Really, what's that? It's marijuana, really? So you're telling me for a couple of hours it's going to make me feel that little 30-second buzz that I felt with the cigarette for this long, right? So then you have someone comes on and says something different. Hey, you run into someone else. Hey, I found something else. And it makes you, you know, feel this type of way for 10 hours. What? Really? What is it? It's crack cocaine or heroin. What? Really? Right? So now it's like a different rush. And I think that's what gets people caught up. They're chasing an adrenaline rush. And it's a positive and a negative side to, you know, adrenaline rush. The thing now, my adrenaline rush is something different. I'm chasing to be more successful, being more of a mogul, being more of a beacon of light to people when they see me. And they're like, Sherrod, you grew up in Detroit and you went to prison, but wait a minute, you write books now? So now instead of me selling the dime bags of marijuana, you mean I could sell a book for $10 and still hustle it the same way? Because if you think about it, Jay-Z is doing the same thing. The same mindset that he had when he was selling drugs in the streets, that same mindset, instead of doing it that way, now he's like owning basketball teams and running his own clothing line. So it has a different business mindset. So he changed that around. And now he's as successful as he is today. So I'm chasing that same. Now I'm chasing a different pattern now. So my adrenaline rush is different. And now it's even more exhausting and tiring than it was when I was doing the negative.
Right, right. It's funny how you mentioned the progression when you're talking about wanting a little buzz from a cigarette and then moving on into the marijuana, and then eventually it's a pathway into crack cocaine and heroin and all those other things out there. And, you know, there's a lot of people that open Pandora's box because a lot of people don't know that they have the predisposition to be an addict who cannot control the snake once they get it out the box. And it is a snake, and it's very cunning, and it's baffling. And a lot of people don't make it out. They wind up chasing that high until the grave. So it's crazy. So, you know, we do have those pivotal moments in our lives, most of us, that alter our path. And so do you remember that precise moment that led you down a path that would lead to your prison sentence?
Yes, I do. And this is when I knew. It was a moment where the person who I got incarcerated with, you know, I came back home from Canada, heard about a lot of things that he was doing. So we had a conversation. Now, I'm having a type of conversation. It was probably one of the most mature conversations I ever had with someone who I called a friend at the time. So it's summertime. It's probably around May, June. And I set him in my car. People were calling me. I'm ignoring the calls. People were pulling up on us, you know, in the neighborhood, and I didn't roll my window down. I'm talking to him. I say, hey, listen, man, I heard about, mind you, I'm like 20 at the time. So I say, I heard about a lot of things that you're doing right now, and I'm about to tell you right now. You know I'm not that type of individual, right? So if you continue to doing what you're doing, I'm not going to be able to hang with you. I don't want you to bring this stuff around me. Like, I don't want you riding my car if this is the type of perception that people are looking at you as, right? And he said, yeah. I understand. He said, you're right, right? So in my mind, I'm thinking I made my point, right? So this goes back to what I talked about when we first started about being firm in what you're saying. So he understood. We talked about half an hour to an hour. Now, this is the point where I knew, like, I had broken that which I had said the next time I let him back in my car. That's when I knew I wasn't supposed to have even done that, right? So it's like you know. It's like if you know, but then you not listen to that voice that's in your head. You know, it's always a, man, something told me to do that, or something told me not to do that. Those little voices right there is what we should listen to. And that's what I knew right there. It wasn't going to end up good.
Wow. Well, I have to tell you, just like you said, there are those voices in our head, and I believe that it's the voice of God saying, you know, don't. And then we wind up doing it, and then we wind up in a situation to where, because we didn't listen, you know, now we have to pay the consequences. So when we're talking about the consequences that you had to pay as a young man, you know, the whole prison thing, you know, and I've only seen movies about prison, and they have this lockup thing that one of my roommates liked to watch, but what was life like in prison for you while you were there?
Man, you know, every time I talk about this, I kind of like, I don't get emotional, but like people can hear like what I'm saying, like I'm really serious. Like that place, man, it's real. It's nothing but a negative vibe, man. I mean, from the moment that you walk in, you're just surrounded. The first day I went to jail, I had two options to sleep in that cell. And I'm in a cell with 30-some people, and we're in this little cell, probably the size of an actual person's bedroom.
Right? Wow.
And when I walked in there, I was so young, and I'm just in there, man. I had two options. You know, I come in, you consider fresh fish, right?
Uh-huh.
Option number one to sleep, I had the option to sleep under the toilet.
Oh, damn.
I'm not kidding you not. That was option number one. Now, option number two was to sleep at the front gate, meaning every time that gate opened, I got to deal with someone stepping over me and walking out. I got to deal with the guards coming, banging on the door, telling everybody it's time to eat. So I had two options. You know, I had to take the second option where I chose to sleep by the front door. Mind you, I'm sleeping on the floor. There's no covers. I had to take my shirt off just to be a pillow, so I wouldn't have my head on a bare floor. But when you're going into prison, man, it sets you, you have to be already ready. You know, I talked to a lot of older people, you know, when I was locked up, that been down 20 years, because I wanted to get as much information as I could to help me these next, you know, whatever time, at the time I didn't know what they was going to give me, but I was talking to them because I wanted to be mentally prepared. Because if you're not mentally prepared to go into prison, man, it's going to chew you up. You know, in there, you know, you have people, my first day in actual prison, someone tried to kill himself. I came hearing them all night. I'm hearing coughing. Someone just coughing all night. And guys are, at this time, I'm in there, it's like a bird cage. So it's just people all around you, in front of you, in back in your cells. And if someone is coughing all night, and guys are getting mad because they can't sleep. Can you please shut up? And this, and that. So I'm overhearing people talking in the yard, and it was like, you know, that person that was calling, like, was trying to kill himself. He actually was trying to swallow a razor kill himself. So that's where the coffee came up. So now you hear things like that, man, and now, you know, especially when you're young, you're like, man, what did I get myself into? So reality sets in real quick, and you're either going to deal with it or it's going to deal with you, right? It's the old saying, be humble or be humble. So you definitely have to transition, man. It's like a world inside of a world. There's no females. There's no cars. There's no alcohol. Well, of course, you made your own, you know, illegally. But those things you don't have, and now all you have is what you have to deal with. So now you're forced to read people. You're forced to, you know, to study everyone that's around you or look at different groups, because in there, gangs are serious. People go into prison with no friends, but they're looking for friends, right? And that's what set me apart from other people, because why not? I wanted it by myself. And you hear Kevin Hart talk about it for real, you know, but even though he was being funny, like, it's serious. Like, you go in there by yourself. Now, do you remain that way or not? I go in there, I chose not to hang around gangs. Hanging around the wrong people is what got me here in the first place. So now I'm going to here. I'm only going with two people, and that's me and God. So I'm going to hell with a face. Like, I don't need, I never, 6 years, I never carried a shank, never walked around with knives, never got into a fight. And I'm a basketball player. I got into a lot of altercations playing basketball, but I never had to fend for myself where my back was against the wall. Never had to deal with anyone trying to rape. Never. Never dealt with it. And the whole time I was by myself. And people noticed that. People respect you for that. I remember one time I got into it with a guy on the basketball court because we were winning the playoff games, and after that, and we got into it on the court. After the game was over, I went into my cell, took a shower, changed my clothes, came back out. I didn't come out looking for him. And one guy said, man, I noticed something. I say, after that little situation, you went in there and took a shower, changed clothes, and came back out like nothing happened. He said, I respect you for that. Because most guys, when they're getting into it, they don't know what the other guy is thinking, right? But because me just having faith, like, I'm not going to have any type of situations that, you know, God has my back, I came out with that attitude. God's respecting me the whole time. So it definitely... I'm listening.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead.
So it definitely puts you in a mindset where, you know, you're forced to mature, you know, so...
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I think that was a very powerful testimony, one that I'm so glad that it's recorded, because like you said, you went in there with yourself and you went in there with God. And just listening at some of the opportunities that could lead to devastating outcomes, you actually bypassed that. And it sounds to me just like many people that are spiritual say, the higher power protected you while you were in there. So when you, while you were in there and you were bypassing a lot of the adversities that were in there, was there ever a point, because like you said, you were there 6-7 years, was there ever a point when you felt like you wouldn't survive?
Absolutely. And you're going to get that. I remember the first day that I was actually, you know, went to jail. Like, I called my mom crying. And I told her, I don't think I'm going to make it. This is something that I've never experienced before. All I have is what I see on TV. And, you know, you see about prison on TV, you really don't think about it that much. It's like, okay, I see this on TV, but, is this really real? So when I got to that point where, like I just, you know, been involved in something where this can go, like, all bad. So it definitely was a point where I felt like I wasn't going to make it, because you get lonely. You know, you being in there, even though you had the support of your family, like going to sleep, man, and it just sometimes feel like, I don't think I'm going to survive this thing. So it was definitely times where I felt like that, but I ultimately, you know, worked it out through the support with my mom, you know, my grandma, my dad, and my family, and I was very, you know, grateful for that. So I made it through. And now I'm a better man today, and, you know, I'm moving forward, you know, with my book and everything else that I got going on. But it definitely set me off, because it gave me more of an entrepreneurial mind. Because when I was creating that book and I was figuring out how to publish it, like, to do that is, like, extremely powerful. You know what I'm saying? To be in that position where even though you're doing time, I'm going to write a book, you know. And what sets me different than a lot of people, and I'm not the only person that's done this, but think about it. Everybody goes to prison, comes out, they always want to do what? Be a rapper, right?
Right. Now, exactly.
Everybody wants to be a rapper, but a lot of people come out here and they forget that. You know, me, there's a lot of people in prison, they always, you know, a lot of people are poets and writing books, but a lot of people never actually follow through with it. I could have waited till I got home to publish my book, but what kind of testimony of what could I have proven to myself, right, if I would have had just waited? A lot of us got dreams and stuff that we don't do now, but we're waiting so long. Now it's 20 years later. Now what we could have done 20 years later, we at the age now where it's like, oh, man, I wish I would have did that. You know, so now that's less motivated. So instead of that, I acted on it then. you know, and started publishing my book then and got it out, made sure that I got it out before I came home.
I think it's a very powerful testimony of not only courage, but ambition and passion and channeling what could definitely have been vibes that could have went the alternate direction to become a product of the environment rather than becoming an eagle soaring out of that environment into higher heights. So you talked about the book, and this is why we're here today as well. Thank you for being so candid about your experiences in prison, because I think that it will inspire someone else listening to the broadcast. So let's talk about the book, When Water Becomes Thicker Than Blood. And for those of you who are tuning in, I am talking with the author, Sherrod O'Neill Glosson, about his book, When Water Becomes Thicker Than Blood. What is the book about, Sherrod?
This book here, it's about family ties, man, and relationship with friends. I mean, the book is not about me at all. But I guess now lately I've been thinking about it, like, there are some things that I was probably expressing throughout the book that I probably have went through throughout my life. So even when my family reads this book, a lot of them think that it's about me. And I'm like, well, wait, I never did that, you know. But I can see what they are talking about, you know. So the book talks about family. It talks about friendships. It also talks about a young man's experience with God. What is his view on God? You know, so it goes back and forth, man, about, you know, living, you know, with things like this. Like, how do you deal? Like, if my family say that they are family, well, how do I deal with you saying that you're my brother, but you want to kill me, right? Or if you are my mother, that you want to do something bad to me, right? And I have this friend who I confide in who want nothing but the best for me or have my back more than my actual family does. Like, and if you look at today's society, like, that's really happening, right? So when a lot of people read my book, it's not far-fetched. You know, you have a lot of authors, and not to take anything away from them, but a lot of people make stories that are far-fetched, right, where people are like, well, it's just a story. You know, that was a good story, you know, fictional story. And they'll look at mine, and they'll be like, man, did that really happen? People still ask me now, like, that one scene, did that really happen? And even though I talk about things in there that have never been involved of, you know, I just heard about it, you know, because I believe that authors, they're writing about things that they're either experienced, know someone who experienced or thought about experiencing this or going through something like this. So that's right. What makes up a book. So when you look at my story, that's what it's primarily about.
All right. And who's the main character in the book?
The main character is LC. LC is a Detroiter, a guy out of Detroit. He definitely grew up with, you know, family who showed him, you know, a different a way of life. It's like this. How can a person tell me, and a lot of people go through this, how can you tell me to not do a certain thing, but you want to expose it around me, right? That's like, that's like your family or telling me, how can you tell me you don't want me to drink or you don't want me to smoke weed, but I made a mistake and walked in your room and I saw you doing it.
All right. You better talk.
So it's that whole thing right there, man. So LC dealt with that. How are you going to show me this? But when I made a mistake and I just happened to just go outside in the back with you and all your friends, I saw you doing everything that you told me not to do. So by LC learning that growing up, he started acting on these things. But LC also is living good. You know, he also did time in prison. But in prison, or before then, you know, he came out and he started doing positive things. You know, and he also kept a nice crowd of people around him. So wherever he go, he knows someone. He has the reputation, oh, he's a good dude. You know, that's a good reputation. Like, your name is better than gold. You know, you don't want nobody knowing your name. I don't want nobody no longer coming up to me and saying, hey, Sherrod, hey, there goes Sherrod. You know, he went to prison, you know, for armed robbery. No, that's not the reputation. I want, even though I did that and I talk freely about it, but when I see people, I want them to be like, that's Sherrod. Yeah, he went to prison, but look at what he's doing now, right? So that's what the book, you know, LC, you know, is that what he went through, you know, in the book. And And he had a lot of good relationships. If you'll see in the book, he had more friendships than family ships. I don't even think that's the actual word. It's going to be a word today.
If you put it in quotations, it's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know what I want to do? I want to take a break. We got like about 10 minutes. I want to see if we could take a call. So here, hold on a second. Let me see if I could get this moving right here. Okay. So we have a caller from 313-670. Would you like to ask the author a question? Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Yes. I wanted to ask him, would you say that jail was the best thing or the worst thing in farther of your career?
That is a good question. I'm going to say it was definitely a chapter that I enjoyed reading myself at the same time. You know, you have those life chapters where, or chapters in the book where even though you enjoy reading it, you still were very emotional about it, right? So prison actually helped that because it gave me, or should I say God gave me the ability to sit down. So you can even try it now. I tell people this, like, you don't have to go to prison to be in prison. Try sitting in the house on a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday where it's 90 degrees outside and everyone's out partying and watching you come up with turn the phone off, turn the TV off, close the doors, paint them black if you want to, if you don't want no sunshine to come in, and watch what happened to you. Because they say in the darkness, well, if you see a little speck of light, you're going to go look for that light, and you're going to find it and find your way out.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right,
calling.
Thank you. And thank you. Thanks for supporting the show, 313-670.
Okay.
All right.
You're welcome.
All right. That is so cool. I like how you explained that, and I appreciate the caller for calling in, supporting the show, and I appreciate that question that she asked. And you're right, you could be in prison without even being in prison. So what I wanted to get into is another part of your life that I think is amazing. You have mentioned having a book signing 2 days after your release. So who helped you put that together, and what venue did you have it at?
GD, man, I wanted to come out of prison, man, running. Like, I was built with high energy. You know, from the moment that I wrote that book. And it's funny because, you know, if you're in prison, the guards treat you a certain type of way. You know, you're out on that doggy out, want to bother you all the time. When I wrote that book, you know what the prison guards started calling me in it? They started calling me a local celebrity. Right?
All right.
So now they started treating me a little bit different. Like, and what was funny is because other guards started coming up to me and asking me, like, are you the one that wrote the book? And I'm like, I never even seen you before. Like, how long have you been working here, right? Even the warden and lieutenants, they wanted to read my book. They wanted to know who I am. So I wanted to let the world know who I was other than just the prison people. So when I came out, I had my mom, and I had a high school friend by the name of Sonetta Jones. She's working with Worldwide Core Radio. And their internet radio station. So when I got with her, you know, she was supportive from the day that we connected. Mind you, I started my Facebook when I started writing, so in 2010. And when I came home 2 days after, I had a book signing at a park. It was absolutely, didn't have to come out no money. I didn't have to pay for her getting me on the show. So it was definitely, you know, a good thing. So when I did it, I was kind of nervous, and what's funny is, like, I wasn't used to being around different people now. Like, now I was used to being around the same guys, you know, that I've been around. Like, the guys that was in there knew me more than my own mom at that point because they're around me every day. So they're seeing the change, right? I came home, and that day, Saturday, I was doing push-ups in my grandmother's basement, right? Because I'm used to working out, and I'm used to, that's how I clear my mind. So my auntie, I walked downstairs, she's like, what are you doing? I'm like, it's a question. Why? I said, well, I'm kind of nervous a little bit. So I did the book signing, man. It went well. That was my first radio interview. The book signing went well. Family came out. Friends showed out. And then after that, I just kept doing them. I was speaking in youth programs. The following week, I spoke at someone's testimonial dinner where Coleman Young, I think the second, was there, and Karen Clark Shear, they was present. So I did more book signings. I worked on a TV show here in Detroit called Before There Were Stars TV. So I definitely came out, you know, with high energy. And I think that's what keeps, you know, a person, especially if you're moving on a more or entrepreneurial side, is the high energy that you present, and you just ride that wave, man.
Yeah, yeah, and you're writing it very well, and just hearing the motivation. I just, even from the beginning of the interview to now, I hear the fire in your voice. I hear the inspiration, and most certainly the work that you're doing it on the humanitarian side, because you're out there showing people, being a living example of a positive truth that can come from hard work and believe in God and belief in God and belief in self. So the question that I want to ask now, I want to go ahead and get this in on the broadcast. Where can people purchase your book?
Yeah, you can purchase the book off Amazon.com. I even have it on Amazon Kindle, so you could definitely go on there. My books are affordable. They're only $10. And then I have it for $5 on the Kindle. But you could definitely go on Amazon.com and just click in the title of the book, which is When Water Becomes Thicker Than Blood. Or you could just punch in my name, Sherrod O'Neill Glosson, and it's going to come right up. But it's a good read, man. It's a page-turner. And I created it like that because I don't like reading books when I'm reading it for chapters and then, you know, the next three chapters is something boring. So every time you turn the page, you're going to want to keep reading. I sell people books in 3 hours. They'll call me or send me a message on Facebook like, I finished reading this book. And I'm like, whoa, I just seen you 3 hours ago. So it's definitely a page turner. It's definitely on the front of the book, I have something you got to read. You got to experience this.
I think what you're doing and what you have accomplished in such a short period of time and overcoming adversity is a true example of your character and of your heart. And most certainly, now that this is a recorded broadcast that will be in the archives of A Touch of Grace, people will actually go back and listen. And I know that you will gather more fans and touch more people with your inspirational book. So what inspirational message would you like to send out today to the listener who might be in that darkness that you spoke about, looking for light?
See, I tell people like this, just look at where you're at in your life right now. I mean, if your life is in complete shambles and you're like, I don't know what to do with myself, you know, you have to figure out, your why factor has to increase. Like, you have to know, why do you want your life to be better rather than I just want my life to be better? You have to really figure that out. Because we are being so much of a terrible circumstance or terrible situations like that, we succumb to that. And then when we succumb to that, we only compound to the problem. Like, how do you think my life would have been if I just would have kept saying, I'm in prison doing 6 years. Oh, man, like 6 years, you know. If I would have stayed with that mindset, I wouldn't be where I'm at today. You know, I wouldn't be here mentally. So you definitely have to find out where you want to be in your life and just go after it. Like, it is so much easier nowadays than when it was when I was younger. Like, if I want to learn how to create a T-shirt, all I got to do is Google it, and it's going to run down everything, right? So I don't never have to go to a store to buy a T-shirt where I can just rock my own. Or if I want to buy some products, I can go straight to a Chinese website and get them for cheap and where everybody here is paying top dollar for it, right? So you didn't have to figure that out your why. Like, why do I want to do this? And just go after it.
All right. That's fantastic. And listeners, for you out there, just know, that was a very important point. You got to listen and look for your why, where you can go, because there's so much power within you. So with that in mind, I would like to say Howard Hewitt will be my guest on Wednesday at 1:30 p.m. He was formerly of Shalimar, but he has certainly had an illustrious career in his own right. He's one of the sweetest falsettos in the industry and has been for decades, so hopefully you'll tune in. I thank the caller for calling in, asking the questions, so that we could go ahead and get that recorded as well. I appreciate the support for A Touch of Grace, and I very much so appreciate Sherrod O'Neill Glosson, author of When Water Becomes Thicker Than Blood, for being on the show. And definitely do go out and support his efforts because it is worthwhile. Sherrod, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Oh, man, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on such short notice. I really appreciate it, man. I really do.
No, man, thank you. Well, you know what? I believe in destiny, and it was destiny that led us our paths to cross. So whatever we could do to help you promote your book, let us know, and you have a great week. All right, my friend?
All right, you as well, and thanks for having me again, and continue doing what you're doing, and I support you wholeheartedly, 100%, man.
All right. Thanks a lot. A Touch of Grace fans, it's a wrap. Have a great week.